Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's with you every Monday through Friday, noon to 2 here on WYPR Baltimore, WYPR Frederick in Hagerstown, WYPO Ocean City, and streaming live online through WYPR.org. We thank you again for making Midday part of your day.
This campaign isn't about where we've been. It's about where we're going. It's about what's next. It's about our future. It's about opportunity. It's about building a better Maryland for more Marylanders as we move.
That's part of Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown's acceptance speech following his sweeping victory in the Democratic gubernatorial primary Tuesday. He's now positioned to become Maryland's first African-American governor and the first lieutenant governor to win the top job. But that's only if Anthony Brown beats the Republican nominee, Larry Hogan, who also handily won his party's nomination. Here's Larry Hogan addressing his supporters last night.
Now, recently, Lieutenant Governor said that the general election was just a molehill, a small, insignificant step on his inevitable march to the governor's mansion. Well, with your help, we're going to turn that molehill into a mountain. The arrogant monopoly in Annapolis is expecting a coronation. But I'm putting them on notice tonight that what we're going to give them instead is the toughest fight of their political lives.
Other winners from the primary include veteran state Senator Brian Frosch of Montgomery County, who defeated delegates John Cardin and Aisha Braveboy to win the Democratic nomination for attorney general. And here in Baltimore City, Marilyn Mosby unseated Democratic incumbent Greg Bernstein in the race for Baltimore City State's Attorney. It's Midday Politics this hour. We have a lot to unpack from yesterday's election. We'd like to hear from you. Feel free to call us anytime during this hour of Midday, 410-662-8780, to share your views on the primary election, the voter turnout, and what's ahead in the general election. Our guest this hour again in Studio A, joining us one more time, Melissa Deckman, Chair of the Political Science Department, a professor of political science at Washington College. Nice to see you back here, Melissa.
Nice to be here, Dan. Thank you.
And Barry Raskevar is joining us again. Barry Raskevar, who writes politicalmaryland.com, his commentary on Maryland politics, which also appears in marylandreporter.com. Nice to have you back with us, Barry.
Hey, thank you, Dan.
So surprises, comments of the day, general comments about how this turned out. Melissa, I'll start with you. What, anything here surprise you?
No real surprises regarding the top two races. I think both Anthony Brown and Larry Hogan ran very safe, scripted campaigns. They didn't drift off message, and as a result, I think things went according to plans for both their campaigns.
Barry, how about you?
I'd say wholeheartedly that there were no surprises at the top of the ticket. None were expected. None were delivered. For Doug Gansler, as soon as Heather Mazur proved to be a formidable candidate, although, you know, in the end she didn't garner that much support, but it was enough so that there was no chance that Gansler could win, and you could see it in some of the voting trends in certain counties. Anthony Brown beat Gansler in Baltimore County. He beat Gansler handily in Montgomery County. That's the ball game right there.
We have Anthony Brown with about 51.5% of the vote from Democrats yesterday. Gansler 24%, and Heather Mazur at 21.7%. And the GOP side, Larry Hogan with just about 43% of the vote. David Craig, the Harford County executive, at just under 30% at 29.3%. Charles Lawler at 15%, and Ron George taking up the rear at 12%. What about the race for attorney general? Were you a little surprised by Brian Frosch's win, or at least his margin in that?
I was not surprised whatsoever. Okay. I expected that as momentum started to build and that people became aware of Frosch's credentials versus the credentials that were kind of thin for John Cardin, that it would end up being a runaway, and indeed it was. Frosch even beat Cardin handily in Baltimore County. Frosch had everything going for him in the end. All of the state senators had him on his ticket. He had a lot more money than Cardin. He used it well.
But in the last poll, he wasn't looking that well. he wasn't looking that great in the last poll that the Sun had.
That's right. Well, yeah.
Cardin was still leading, if only by name recognition.
But the problem was there weren't enough polls. So I mean, if you put the polls together, what you saw was that Frosch was rapidly starting to gain.
Mm-hmm.
And with the amount of money he had, he could use that to further his momentum. And then, of course, he had the two big newspaper endorsements in which they were rave endorsements. So I never expected that Frosch would do anything except win easily.
And Melissa, he put his money into TV commercials right at the very end there when those who were paying attention were really paying attention, I guess.
Well, I would add to that on down ballot races, voters really aren't paying attention until the final weeks. And even though the Sun poll had shown that Cardin might have had a slight lead, again, margin of error, you have to consider that too. The narrative was one that Frosch was rapidly building support. His campaign ads were terrific. And they really, I think, showcased just how much experience, his seriousness, and his basically how well-suited he was for the job compared to, of course, John Cardin, whose campaign just imploded in the last couple of weeks.
And in Baltimore City, we have the state's attorney election, an upset here. Greg Bernstein, who is the incumbent, has only been in office one term. He unseated Patricia Jessamy, the long-serving state's attorney, in 2010, I guess it was. I'm trying to remember. Right? 2010. He took office in 2011. He was unseated by Marilyn Mosby, a former prosecutor and who now works for an insurance company, 34 years old. What do we say about this one?
I think what it says is that this could be a very volatile elected position going forward, that Marilyn Mosby's victory may turn out to be a Pyrrhic victory. That 4 years from now, she may have already laid the groundwork and the game plan for her challenger to just blame everything that goes wrong in Baltimore City as crime and violence on the state's attorney. And I'm sure there are already some defense attorneys who have previously looked at this, at running for this office, are going to plan a 4-year campaign to unseat her.
I wondered this last night, the people I was talking to, there were certain positions that you vote for in Baltimore City, Register of Wills, the Sheriff, and State's Attorney. I know the tradition or the law is that we must vote on these folks, including the judges as well, the sitting judges. But I have to ask why. I mean, I know it's law, Barry. I know it's been this way for years, long before I showed up here in Maryland. But those seem like positions that should be appointed or something like that. I don't understand why we vote for these positions.
Well, we had a constitutional convention. We tried to take them out of politics.
In the 70s, was it?
In the 60s.
In the 60s.
In the 1966 was the constitutional convention. It was voted on, I believe, the next year, and it was defeated. It was defeated because the courthouse crowd was powerful. They energized their backers.
Lots of patronage there.
Exactly. Now, what has happened is that there have been some reform efforts, and we have been able to consolidate a lot of these separate clerk offices into one clerk of the courts. So that's been a slight improvement, but the whole notion that you're electing a state's attorney for law enforcement,
judges, I have a problem with the judges too. I know this seems anachronistic to me. This seems like, as Barry says, they did try to change it, but it's been, almost 50 years since that attempt.
And once you give people the right to vote on something, trying to take it back is almost impossible. I've studied a lot about the politics of school board elections, and in many states for a long time, local school board seats were always appointed. And Maryland actually is unique. We still have a couple counties that are set up that way. But essentially, once you start to extend the franchise on these sorts of down-ballot races, getting it back is really difficult. Although, as you point out, ironically, most people don't vote in them. They have no idea who's running for the offices. They're not really well informed about what the positions even do.
Mm-hmm.
I think it does make sense from a governance perspective to have those kinds of positions to be appointed, but not likely to happen anytime soon.
Going back to Mosby, Bernstein, Marilyn Mosby, of course, ran a vigorous campaign, a door-to-door campaign. I think she might have benefited, of course, from her last name. Her husband is a popular city councilman, Nick Mosby. That certainly helped. And considering the turnout in Baltimore City and the turnout statewide, you can see where she could pull that off by blaming the state's attorney for Baltimore's problems.
That's right. she did a very good job of making sure that every time a crime was committed that made the front page of the newspapers, that she was commenting on it and making it clear that, you know, somebody's got to be tough on crime. In a lot of ways, it was a similar type of effort as the one that Bill Swisher used to unseat Milton Allen as state's attorney.
1974.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Now he did it in a more harsher way.
And racially, in a reverse way too. We should point that out.
And it was a reverse racial way, but it was the same thing. That we have a crime problem. This city is a jungle, is what Swisher said. Mosby used a softer tone, but it was the same basic idea that crime is out of control. Somebody's got to take a hand and do something about it. And in Baltimore City, you don't elect the police commissioner, so people have no way of expressing their anger other than let's toss out the state's attorney.
Well, this remains to be seen if she becomes state's attorney. There is a candidate who's trying to get in as an independent, Mr. Neverdon. So we'll have to see how that plays out. Barry Raskovar is here from PoliticalMaryland.com, and Melissa Deckman joining us from Washington College to talk about yesterday's election. If there's something you want to share with us, 410-662-8780, Carroll County, a senatorial race. This is pretty interesting. This is like Eric Cantor in miniature, a congressional prime, a Republican being primaried in miniature. What did I just say?
Frederick County.
Is it partly Carroll too? Carroll, the Brinkley seat, the David Brinkley seat,
yes,
is what I'm talking
about.
Yes,
but it's.
I know he's Frederick, but I think it's partly Carroll County. No?
We'd have to check.
I'll check. What I saw was, anyway, David Brinkley, who is the Senate minority leader, right, considered a very conservative fellow by all those who score conservatives in the Maryland General Assembly, being out-conservated by a delegate named Michael Huff.
Well, it shows you that there are some pockets of Tea Party activity in the state of Maryland. Yeah. They're, of course, not that big a number, but in Western Maryland, in fact, I've been to some Tea Party events. I'm writing a book about the Tea Party, and I do see a lot of activity in that area. And so I think that you had a lot of those activists who pulled together and really put their emphasis on this guy to unseat who was viewed as an establishment figures. You can't get more establishment than being a minority leader in the Senate. And the shame of it is that I think David Brinkley is a good legislator. He's worked well across the aisle, but in a primary electorate climate, working across the aisle is now a political liability.
My goodness. Go ahead.
Well, in Anne Arundel,
and the margin on this is like almost 2-1 or better than 2-1, right?
Oh, yes. There's no doubt that Frederick County voters want a very, very conservative voice in Annapolis. The problem is that now that Frederick County is going to home rule and has its own county executive and county council, the role of a state senator or state delegate from Frederick County is greatly diminished. They have a lot less power than they did before. So Michael Huff may go to Annapolis, although he has a fairly formidable Democratic opponent in Dan Rupley, who has run many times for Congress. But still, the odds are in his favor. He'll go to Annapolis, but in the Senate, he may find that he's just a voice crying into the wind.
410-662-8780. Barry Raskovar and Melissa Deckman with us this hour. We talk Maryland politics the day after the primary. Please give us a ring or send us an email with a comment or question midday@wypr.org. Lots of comments about the election on Facebook. I'll read some of those. We'll be right back. 410-662-8780. So I just looked at the legislative district map, and as you would expect, Barry Raskovar was right. So District 4, the one that David Brinkley was running in and that Michael Huff unseated him in, will now face Mr. Rupley in the general election. That is all Frederick County. I guess in the past it had some of Carroll in it as well. Carroll County is legislative District 5, according to the Maryland legislative map. A question came in from one of our listeners, Evelyn in Dundalk. Could Barry and Melissa please comment on what the voting results mean for Heather Mazier's future in politics? I voted for her and hope to see a lot more of her, maybe in the next round for governor or possibly in the U.S. Congress. Melissa, what do you think?
You know, I think that Heather Mazier took a lot of people by surprise. She ran a very positive campaign, and I think she leaves this election with a positive future. I think her her biggest contribution was that she was able to keep progressive issues being discussed among the candidates. And so she was pushing the party more toward what the progressive base of the party likes to see. And so I think that she's well positioned to run maybe for Congress. I wouldn't be surprised if she's tapped to be in a Brown administration if, you know, Brown is, in fact, elected governor in the fall. I will also note that Heather Mazur won Kent County. That was the only county she carried. She and her wife own an organic farm out
there.
That's
right. They have a farm there.
So I think, you know, she resides there part-time. So
is that where Washington College is?
That is where Washington College is.
Chestertown.
So. Right.
Yeah, she has said that she would, she and her partner, her married partner, will be moving to the Eastern Shore. We'll see if her thoughts have changed. But I think you also have to remember she only got 21% of the Democratic vote, which is about what a progressive, the liberal wing of the party would get in a race like this, 20 to 25%.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, she made a very good representation, but I think it could be fleeting that this doesn't show any huge surge in progressivism within the Democratic Party.
That's about what you would expect from any candidate running with that sort of agenda.
Yes.
And from the left.
You know, what I think, though, arguably, no one knew her from Adam before this campaign started. And I think had Doug Gansler not been in the race, that she probably could have done a little bit better. I still think Anthony Brown would have won the election by far, and we see that he did that. But I think that she actually, considering where she started, did a pretty good job.
Well, I think you look at it the other way, too. If Heather Mazur had not been in the race, we would have had a very close contest between Anthony Brown and Doug Gansler.
You think it would have been closer?
Well, the numbers would seem to indicate it would have been a lot closer. Then again, Gansler did not run a very good campaign.
Yeah, I mean, very close, razor thin. I mean, if you take Gansler and Mazur's vote, you get about 45% to Brown's 51%. You think that would have been the margin?
It could have been the margin. This is all speculation.
It is. I wonder what a one-on-one primary would have been like.
But the point is that Gansler did not do as well as he himself expected. He only won a handful of jurisdictions, and, you know, he got blown away in his home county.
410-662-8780 is our number here. Charles in Baltimore, we'll go to you. Charles, welcome to Midday.
Hello.
Go right ahead, please.
Do you think Maryland has a chance of picking up a Republican seat in the U.S. House of Representatives, especially in the 6th Congressional District? There is only one Republican representative of 8, Andy Harris, in the 1st.
Mm-hmm. Good question. So he's referring, I guess, to Dan Bongino?
Yes.
Dan Bongino now is a Republican nominee who will challenge John Delaney, who is a first-term incumbent Democrat.
Right. Yep. And Bongino does not live in the district either.
I think he lives in Anne Arundel County, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the district is mostly Western Maryland and a big chunk of Montgomery County.
Well, here's the thing. They redrew the district lines last time. That's why John Delaney was able to defeat Roscoe Bartlett. Now the majority of the voters are in Montgomery County, and that's John Delaney's stronghold. That's all he really needs to win. Plus, you do have pockets of Democratic strength in Frederick City, in Cumberland, in Hagerstown. There are plenty of Democrats to add to the Montgomery total. So for a Republican to win this time, I think, is a long shot.
To get back to Charles' original question, are there any Republicans likely to emerge in Congress after this election? No.
Yeah.
As Barry pointed out, the districts were redrawn in such a way that Democratic voters are heavily favored in most of those races. And, of course, what they did was they put all the Republicans in Harris's district.
In the first
so that
district.
Is a very safe Republican
right.
district. It was completely
gerrymandered.
I just want to go over that
with you a little bit. You just said very safe.
Mm-hmm.
Very safe for Andy Harris
yes.
for the foreseeable future, just based on the numbers and registration.
I would say yes.
You both agree on that.
Very.
So
I mean,
you're not going to see a Democrat, even a conservative Democrat, emerge to challenge him or with any seriousness?
I can't think of one at this point. Maybe Heather Mazur will move to the Eastern Shore and decide to run for Congress. That would be interesting.
You certainly would.
but the whole nature of the Eastern Shore and Harford and Baltimore counties that are in that first congressional district would have to change. In politics, you never know.
Let's take another call. Liz, right here in Baltimore, calling midday on WYPR. Go right ahead with your question, Liz.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question goes back to what you were talking about earlier, the judges. And as a voter who tries to be responsible in my voting, I mean, I got what you were saying, but it's very frustrating when you don't know who these people really are.
All right, Liz, could you just sit still for a minute? Go ahead. Because
yeah.
There's some background noise, so go ahead.
Sorry.
Yeah. Where are you, Liz?
Yeah,
out on the porch?
So,
what are you doing?
Yeah, I'm on the porch now. I think this should be better. I hope
okay.
It's better.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry. I was just coming into the house when you picked up my call.
All right.
What I was saying was that with voting for the judges, I mean, I got what you guys were talking about earlier, but as a voter who wants to know who I'm voting for, it's very frustrating. And, you know, because I don't know who these people are, and so there's really no point voting because you never hear who they are. You don't know what their records are. You don't know.
Can we take 5 minutes and talk about this? I mean, I know Barry used to be on the editorial board of the Baltimore Sun, longtime reporter, a political reporter. So I know you've been over this over the years. And I've always I've thought about it many times. Judges in Maryland, circuit court judges, are appointed by the governor. They're nominated and they're approved. They go on the bench. And within a couple of years, they have to run for election, right?
Well, one of the reforms that did eventually come out of the Constitutional Convention under Marvin Mandel was that they created a new lower level of the judiciary called the district court, replacing the municipal court in Maryland. And all those judges are appointed by the governor for I believe, 10-year terms. And they are not subject to election.
Correct, but it's
however,
a circuit
the
court.
Circuit court judges right. are subject to election, and the orphans court judges.
Yes,
and no one knows a thing about them. There was an upset out in Baltimore County among orphans court judges. I believe there was an upset in Baltimore City as
yes,
well.
Yes, there is. I might be writing a column about that. But let me just explain to people that judges who are appointed to the circuit court, who get to the circuit court, have to run for election within a couple of years after their appointment, right?
Yes.
And it's a 10-year term.
It's I believe that's a 15-year term.
15?
Yes.
Okay.
Maryland is not the only state that does this, by the way.
Okay.
So, in fact, I think the majority of states have a system like this whereby a governor appoints a judge, and then there's sort of a referendum campaign, essentially, that's held. But in reality, I think as the caller so ably voiced, it's almost impossible to find information about these individuals.
Well,
unless, of course, there's been some scandal. If there's been a scandal,
right.
then maybe this is where the voters
can
check.
Or even if they've been reported to the what's called in Maryland the Judicial Disabilities Commission, right? It's very hard to get information on that. So this, as an informed citizen, when you're handed a flyer as you walk into a poll, vote for the sitting judges of Baltimore County, the sitting judges of Baltimore City, whatever county it is, right? Most people, maybe they know the name, recognize the name, maybe not, probably not, right? So how do we inform voters about the judges? Do we, like, roll out their record, convictions, long sentences? Or I mean, how do you judge a judge?
The only way you can judge a judge is if there's a controversy surrounding the judge. Judge Alfred Nance in Baltimore City Circuit Court has had a lot of controversies about the way he runs his courtroom, whether he disparages certain defense attorneys. He was challenged this time by Paige Kreuter.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was that there were other sitting judges running who were also endangered. So the bar, the legal community, circled the wagons around all of the sitting judges. And consequently, once again, the sitting judges were elected, and we didn't have a chance to actually have a referendum on Judge Nance. Now, let me go a step further. In Maryland, another reform was that appointments to the Maryland Court of Appeals for 15 years do have to run for another term.
I've seen them on the ballot, yeah.
However, that's an up or down vote. There's no challenger. So if you had a controversial member of the Court of Appeals in Maryland, you could vote that person out of office.
So in the case of the Circuit Court and the Court of Special Appeals, the only time voters would be focused on a particular judge would be after controversy. In controversy is what you're saying. Otherwise, my question about how do you judge the judges? Say, how does a newspaper set out to give a complete, comprehensive profile of a particular circuit court judge over his or her term for the last 2 years or 10 years? How would you propose to do that if you were the editor of the Baltimore Sun assigning a reporter to do that?
Well, you'd have to talk to a whole bunch of defense attorneys and some people who worked in the prosecutor's office to find out which of the sitting judges running for re-election were problems.
There's no voting record. What you just said is a good idea. If you were my editor, I'd say, yeah, you're right. That's what I should go do. And that's but those are subjective opinions from members of the bar, right?
Yes, but they're subjective opinions, and they would point to specific cases that could then be researched, and you could go back to the transcript to find out if the judge talked out of turn or was dismissive or talked down to defendants or attorneys or said something that was really outrageous.
I think the Founding Fathers had it right, you know, and looking at
well,
the design.
Melissa goes to the Founding Fathers. Thank you, Professor.
In the design of the federal government, you know, judges were appointed, and there's a check involved by having the Senate approve the appointment by the president. But there's also the sense that being a judge should be nonpartisan. It should be not political. And so we should put the best and the brightest on the bench and try to remove those political influences. So I worry about states that are electing judges where you have interest groups giving money to support judges who are pro-gun or anti-gun legislation. And I think that's actually problematic. I'd rather have people who were appointed on the merits through a pretty rigorous system of checks and balances at another level. Because in reality, I would guess that most voters who are going to vote for these people in goodwill have no idea what even is on a judge's docket, let alone, you know, what a good decision is from a bad decision.
And think about judges on the campaign trail. This has always troubled me a little bit. They have to go out and raise money so they can have signage, right? They have to stand on street corners and wave to people. But I don't mind that so much as the money raising. Who do they raise money from? Members of the bar a lot, right?
Or businesses lawyers. Or corporations who have cases that might be
appearing
in front
cases,
of them.
Right.
This is why they have a committee formed to reelect the sitting judges so that judges don't have to do the fundraising. Right. But the problem is that their opponents can raise the money from anybody, can appear at any political event, and meanwhile, the sitting judges are restrained as to they can't go to political events. Most political events are off limits to them.
410-662-8780 if you'd like to comment on that. Stephanie wants to comment on this as a question of voting for judges. She says, I like voting for judges. I think we should have more votes for judges to ensure that the legal and court system is working for the people as opposed to serving the interests of the bureaucracy. I think judges and attorneys' performances should be held up to more scrutiny. 410-662-8780. Another call here. This is Dwayne in Woodstock, Maryland. Thanks for calling, Dwayne.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Hey, I've got a question about Anthony Brown's running mate, Ken Ullman. I was at a party the other night, and I got involved with a conversation with a friend was pretty animated about the fact that Ken Ullman seems to have a lot of ties to money, corporations, campaign financing. This is sort of a two-tiered question because, first of all, I'd like to know from the panel how much they know about Ken Ullman's ability to raise money and how transparent he is and exactly who is this guy. But also, it cuts to the question, Citizens United, you know, when is money free speech? How does it influence campaign financing?
Barry, you want to take that? I mean, I assume he's under the same reporting requirements as...
Yes, he is. And as far as I know, he's as transparent as all the other candidates were this last time around. He did raise a lot of money, but the county executive in Howard County works with a lot of corporations that are residents, you know, that have their headquarters or their offices in Howard County, so there would be nothing unusual about that. You know, he has to do a lot of economic development work and working with them, so of course they would turn around and support him. Now, one of the interesting elements in this campaign, as far as the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court, was this story late in the campaign that John Cardin, running for attorney general, had received $250,000 from a committee that had been set up only a few days earlier in Florida, and that when the individual who was in charge of this committee was contacted, that individual refused to say who had given the money. That's the real danger to the Citizens United decision, that you could have anonymous giving not $250,000, but maybe $2.5 million mm-hmm. to a candidate at the last minute.
And really influencing the outcome.
Exactly. Yeah. And then we, the voter, have no idea who is supporting him. Is it Boss Tweed? Is it J. Pierpont Morgan? Who is
this?
Is
the first time we've seen something like that in Maryland, something on that scale since Citizens United?
Yes.
Yeah. Let's go to another caller, Kathleen in Baltimore, with a question for us. Hello.
Hi. My question is this. I vote in every election. I do my research. I knew, of course, whom I wanted to vote for governor and attorney general and who should represent me in the House of Delegates. And then I did what a lot of people do, which is that I skipped all of those questions about races that I know nothing about and, you know, have no way of researching, which is orphan court judge and various other judges. So my question is, does anyone know what percentage of voters who actually vote skip all those questions? I don't want to guess. I just skip them.
You know what, Kathleen, you could do this. I don't have time to do it now on the air. This is what probably what Barry and Melissa would do. Go to the Maryland State Board of Elections. They have all the results there, all those down ballot races. And you can compare the total number of votes cast in those down ballot races with the top of the ticket in any jurisdiction, Baltimore City or any of the counties of Maryland. So go to the Maryland Board of Elections. All the results are there today, and most of them are in by now, up to 98%, I think.
It's a very common phenomenon. I mean,
what are you supposed to do?
So
feel,
that a lot
guilty,
of voters just,
right?
You know, in some, it leads to some quirky results. You know, I know that sometimes alphabetical order suddenly takes more importance on some of those down ballot races, which is not really the point of having an election to begin with. But I think Kathleen should feel not alone. A lot of people do the same sort of thing.
It's sort of why signs are so important, right? I mean, you see all these signs out there, and you wonder, does this really make a difference to people? But a sign puts a name in people's heads.
Name recognition is extremely important in down ballot races, and these are campaigns where actually meeting potential voters and asking for votes really can help. I will say this about getting information about those races: I always tell my students who are looking for information about these races to look at the local newspapers. So, in fact, I live in Crofton, and so I got the Crofton Gazette, you know, the week before, and they have a whole series where they actually ask people who are running for these offices. Some of them even actually went as far as saying, this is what the orphan of the courts does, you know, this director.
Right.
And it was really pretty helpful. I will note this, though, interestingly enough, to bring it back to the governor's election, the only candidate not to have submitted answers in writing for all of these races was Larry Hogan.
In the Crofton
in
Gazette?
And these are softball questions. These are, what are your top three priority? I mean, these are softball questions, which I think is really interesting.
You may actually refuse, or you just didn't get back to the publication?
Did not get back. I mean, every single race, every other candidate who was running answered questions.
That's where the rubber meets the road, in the local newspapers and the local races. Anyway, listen, we're going to take a little... Oh, before we take the break, I just wanted to hear from Matt. Matt had a good question, I think, that would set up maybe the rest of this hour as we move ahead and look to the general election in November. So, Matt, go right ahead and ask Melissa and Barry what's on your mind.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah,
I just want to ask your panel, you know, a lot of the campaigns we saw were running against the O'Malley administration, you know, and obviously by inference against Brown and his campaign. Given at this point that Brown's, you know, the presumptive Democratic candidate, do you think that a lot of the people who voted for Gantler, and independents and Mazier will end up switching to Hogan as a moderate, or are they going to toe the party line and drive behind Brown? I think it's going to. I'm curious how that's going to be predicted at this point.
You know, Larry Hogan last night in his speech was trying to reach out, in fact, to Doug Gansler and Heather Mazier voters. The chances that someone who voted for Heather Mazier will vote for Hogan, I think, are pretty slim. It's not to say that he doesn't have a chance in the fall. I think there are a couple things that could happen. First, you have to remember that in midterm elections, unlike presidential elections, Republicans are more likely to turn out than Democrats. Now, of course, we have way more Democratic voters in the state, right? But that, I think, works to Hogan's advantage. I think the vagueness of his campaign works to his advantage as well, because he is not on the record for supporting anything that's very, very conservative. So he's going to be reaching out to those independent voters. And I would also point out, you know, Anthony Brown won easily, But, you know, half of the Democratic voters didn't vote for him. So I think there are enough disaffected Democrats in the state who are kind of want change. They don't want taxes. They maybe don't want more O'Malley Brown. So it is a possibility. Is it likely? Probably not, but it's certainly possible.
Well, I mean, they could just sit out, too. Mazir voters may
not
be that excited about Anthony Brown, may not be inclined to go out and vote. And as we saw yesterday, a lot of people were disinclined to vote. That could carry over to November. Barry?
Yeah, well, you did not see either Mazur nor Gansler indicate in any way, shape, or form that they were suddenly going to bolt from the Democratic Party and support Larry Hogan. I think Anthony Brown tried to throw out an olive branch to them, and they took it. And, you know, you're going to have a unified Democratic Party marching forward, which is very, very, very bad news for Larry Hogan. However, if events on the national scene go his way and there's massive discontent among the American electorate come November, it's entirely possible that it could be a closer race than we think.
We'll talk some more about that after this short break. That's Barry Raskovar from PoliticalMaryland.com, longtime political observer of Maryland politics, and Melissa Deckman with us, a professor of political science and chair of the political science department at Washington College. This is Midday. You're welcome to call in. Open phone lines now, 410-662-8780. We'll be right back. Coming up in the second hour of Midday, Kenneth Turan, the veteran film critic of the Los Angeles Times and NPR's Morning Edition, joins us to tell us about his favorite films over the years. And Midday contributor Christopher Llewellyn Reed pays tribute to the late Eli Wallach, who died yesterday at the age of 98. All that coming up after the news at 1. Laurie writes on Facebook, how is it that Heather Mazir is so easily dismissed as a fringe candidate when only a few percentage points divided her and Gansler? Perhaps if Gansler had not been in the race, there would have been a much tighter race between Mazir and Anthony Brown.
That's true, but she still only got 21% of the vote.
Okay. All right.
That's
all right,
not
Laurie.
50%.
Okay. Yeah. But, I mean, she's not that far from Gansler, is I guess Laurie's point.
Yeah, right? But the point is, that means she finishes second, and except in horseshoes, yeah. You know, okay. Second doesn't do it.
Brian's in Annapolis with a question for us. Hi, Brian.
Hello.
Oh, did we lose Brian? He had a question.
No, I'm here, sir.
Okay, go right ahead.
Yes, sir. I thank you for taking my call. I'm very interested if your panelists could discuss some of the other primary systems we have in the country besides closed primaries, such as what we have in Maryland. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, Melissa, I'm going to give that to you. I just want to say on Facebook today, lots of comments from people saying, I can't vote, I can't vote. I'm a registered unaffiliated. I'm a registered independent. But in Maryland, you can switch if you want to take part in these primaries. That's just the way the system is here. It would take an act of the party or an act of the legislature to change?
The legislature.
The legislature would have to change.
And they're not
the
about to do it. The Democrats are not going to give up their supremacy.
All right, Melissa.
No, so most states around the country have what are known as closed primaries, which is what we have here in Maryland. So this is a system that really works to the benefits of the parties themselves because they don't want independents and other cranky voters who might mess up the narrative to come in and vote in their election. So I don't think it's likely to be changed here in Maryland. Now, other states like Mississippi, for example, I don't know if you were following what happened with the Senator Ted Cochran. Yeah, who was essentially was had to go into a runoff by a tough
Tea Party
challenger.
Tea Party challenger. Yeah.
Well, so Mississippi is a state where anyone can vote in a primary as long as, in that case, they hadn't voted in an earlier primary. So essentially, his strategy in the last 2 weeks was to go out to African-American communities and to get black Democrats who hadn't voted previously to come out and vote in the Republican primary. And so most states, though, do not have open systems. Another problem, though—
Virginia had an open system. We
just
saw
Virginia's, yeah, and Virginia's just its own case because, you know, some years you have conventions where you choose nominees, other years you have primaries. But the other feature of this that is often isn't discussed as much is that the dates for when you can register. So a lot of voters would like to move to a state where you have on-site registration, which would, in fact, I think greatly increase voter turnout, because a lot of people aren't paying attention to the elections until it's a few weeks out. They're like, oh, I think I'm going to go vote. And they realize, oh, if I try to register, I had the registration closed a couple weeks ago.
It's too late, right.
You know? Mm-hmm. And so I think that is a system where whether it be closed or open might be better for voters. But we do have this very closed system. And again, it's because the parties like it that way.
Yeah, in my last column, I talked about this myth that early voting increases the turnout. And in fact, it decreases and depresses the turnout. What does increase the overall turnout is what Melissa was talking about, same-day registration. In states that have used it, the total turnout has increased by as much as 7%.
What about Tuesday? Why not have Alan Friedman was here yesterday talking about Eastern Europe and elections that he's observed there, national elections, of course, but all politics is local. So he says they're all on Sunday over there, Saturday or Sunday.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, wouldn't that make it more convenient? Isn't this the 21st century?
It is and it isn't. Sunday, to a lot of Americans, is a religious day, and they would not vote.
Go in the afternoon. Go after church or after wherever you go.
I think in jurisdictions that have tried Sunday voting, it has not been as successful as they thought. And it's a tradition. It's just a tradition but still, you have to ask the question, why is it in most Western countries turnout is so much larger than it is in the United States?
Well, given what both of you have said about primaries, the tradition of low voter turnout in Maryland primaries, I wonder, why don't the parties just get together, have a convention, we'll elect people to go there from the Central Committee or whatever to the convention, and vote for a nominee, and then the rest of us will show up in November to make a decision.
That might make the party happy in the short term, but typically what happens in those conventions is you get a very, not extreme, but you get definitely the most conservative or most liberal sort of candidate. And so the fortunes in the fall often aren't always as good. So I think like Utah, for example, you end up with, I think recently of Mike Lee, who won a convention over Richard Bennett. He was a longtime conservative candidate. But I do think that they have unintended consequences in the November election.
It's who can shout the loudest at the convention?
Well, it's the Iowa caucuses. Mm-hmm. If you think of the Iowa caucuses is great for democracy, and I just disagree with you. I think it's appalling. And you're taking the right to vote away from people, and instead you're giving them another form of representative democracy. So you're the voters one further step away from actually participating in the electoral
process. Well, I'm not saying I endorse it. I just wonder why that hasn't happened. If it's a given that primary is going to have these low turnouts, we seem to accept that and not be very embarrassed by it. So the most zealous or the most devoted, most diligent citizens and members of each party go out to vote. Wouldn't the same thing basically happen at a convention? I just asked that question. You say maybe not, right? Okay, let's go back to the phone lines. Tracy in Baltimore with a question for our guests. Go right ahead, Tracy.
Hi, I have a question about if there's ever going to be a push for instant runoff campaigns, and just to quickly explain what that is, instead of you voting for, just one person, you vote for your first choice, second choice, third choice, and then if your first choice doesn't make it in the initial voting, your vote would go to the second choice person. So I think it might encourage people to vote where they feel like, I really like, somebody, but my vote's going to get wasted voting for them. Your vote will never get wasted if it's instant runoff. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Interesting.
Well, there are some countries that use this system. So Ireland, for example, is a country that has a similar system. It's very complicated to explain to most people how it works. And so, we can't even convince people to change the registration date, right? In fact, we have many state legislatures, in fact, trying to make it harder for some people to vote in this country.
That's right.
So the idea that we would move to something like this, the political science in me, scientist loves this idea, but in reality, it's probably not going to happen.
Ryan in Remington says, other than an incisive city paper profile, there seemed to be a media blind spot around Marilyn Mosby, who won the state's attorney's election, the primary in Baltimore yesterday. How come? Was there any polling here?
Yeah, as far as I know, there was no polling. The polling was appallingly slim this year. It has to do in part with the fact that the traditional pollsters, such as the newspapers, weren't going to spend the money because they're not making as much as they used to. But it's not just Marilyn Mosby. Most of the candidates were not given the type of in-depth analysis that we're used to seeing in, say, newspapers like The Sun and The Post and some of the new media. We still don't know who Anthony Brown is. We didn't get a lot of background on Doug Gansler either. And going forward, I hope they do a better job for the general election.
All right. That's a good question. Thank you for that one. Vince in Baltimore on email says, I've heard it reported that the June primary date was necessitated by a change in federal law. But I don't understand how federal law affected the date of the Maryland primary. Can one of your guests explain this? And is this change permanent?
I think it has something to do with the fact that a federal law wants to make it easier for military overseas folks to be able to vote and to get their absentee ballots in on time. I'm not 100% convinced, though, that moving it to June was the best solution to the problem.
I think it is an appalling decision by the legislature and the governor, and they'd be foolish not to reverse it. Other states are confronted with the same problem, and they figured out a way to have a September primary. Maryland could do the same thing. They just have to have their leaders determine that it's the right thing to do.
Let's just talk about it for a minute. Because the problem was getting
overseas ballots
to people once the primary is settled, right, for the general election.
And then allotting enough time for them, the people overseas, to get the ballots back.
Okay. And there needs to be a certain number of days for that, obviously. And you say other states have figured out how to have a September primary, get the ballots out with the results of the primary, the new ballot out, and get them back in time for the November election.
Yes, yes. And the fact that you now can do so much by way of the Internet.
Yeah.
There are speedier ways that you can achieve the same result.
You think we might see a move to do that in the legislature, bring it back to September?
Well, you know, the Democratic establishment actually likes this early primary. The lower the turnout, the better for... which is a modern-day equivalent of the machine.
Yeah. One more call. Harry in Severna Park. Harry, I have to keep it short. We're near the end of our first hour. Go ahead.
Hi. Glad to get a hold of you. I can remember, 12 years ago when I had the choice between Representative Ehrlich and Kathleen Kenny Townsend, Lieutenant Governor, and I was disenchanted with both of them. And I just decided not to vote for either of them, and I wasn't real happy with the results, basically. And I voted for Heather Mazier, and I don't see any way that I'm going to be sitting back and not supporting Brown this time.
Yeah. That's what we were commenting on. Melissa was making that point earlier.
I think, too, that you have to remember Mazier, Gansler, and Brown are far more similar than they are dissimilar. Mm. I mean, really, it was on the margins that they were disagreeing on some
policies. Do you think Hogan has a chance?
Anything's possible, yeah. But I do think that it's really probably going to be Anthony Brown's.
It's uphill
win.
Hogan. Right?
It's uphill Hogan, but any decent Republican candidate running for governor should be able to get close to 40%. A very good candidate could get 45, 46, 47%. When you get up to that number, you know, it doesn't take much to get to 50.1%.
I had a back and forth on Twitter this morning with a person who said he doesn't see the point of voting for a Republican governor. We had Bob Ehrlich, and not much happened in the legislature during that time.
Well, Larry Hogan is basically saying, I'm not Bob Ehrlich. Yeah. I'm more of a McKeldin type of conservative Republican, that I get along with people, and Ehrlich didn't.
Barry Raskovar joins us from time to time to talk politics, Maryland politics. That's his gig. Maryland Politics, politicalmaryland.com is Barry Raskovar's blog. You can find a link to it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Melissa Deckman joins us from time to time, too, to talk about Maryland politics. She's based at Washington College in Chestertown in Kent County. Thanks for being here again, Melissa.
Thank you.
Political science professor at Washington College. We'll take a break here for lunch, brought to us today by Breathe Bookstore Cafe in Hamden. Thank you, Barry.
My
and
pleasure.
Thank you, Melissa. We'll see you for the second hour. Please stay with us.